We continue. Almarin Radio. Joining me is Nicholas War. Yeah, I'm looking at him on the internet. It goes by the name of Nick. Nick, before we get going again, you're a writer.
Yes, sir.
Give us the titles. Where do we find them?
My first book was released in 1997, published by Naval Institute Press. And it can be, you can get it anywhere. Any Marine Corps Association bookstore. But mainly people get it on Amazon or my website, which is nicholaswar.com. And I'm proud of that book. It was placed on the Marine reading list. I didn't even know there was such a thing in 1997, but it was placed on the Marine reading list, which at that time was called the Commandant's reading list, and therefore it was required reading inside the fraternity for anyone in infantry, staff sergeant, and above. So a lot of guys, when they went through the basic school and certainly IOC, were exposed to that book, and they were supposed to read it, and a lot of them did, which is, as far as I'm concerned, it's just the coolest thing to happen to a published author. So that's been out there since 97. My second book was published about 5 years ago, and I consider it a prequel to Phazon Green, which really focused on the Battle of Way City during the Tet Offensive, which is right in the middle of the war. And the way that book came about is as a result of Marines and some of my fellow veterans in Vietnam reading the book and phone calls, I started going to reunions every year. And it's basically a 1-5 reunion. And most of us are Vietnam veterans, so we served at one point in time or another during that 5 years that the battalion's flag was in country, starting in late 65, early 66 through March of 71, which is when the battalion came home. And as I attended these reunions, I'd meet guys that I didn't know, I'd never seen, because they were either there before me or after me. And listen to stories. I talk a lot, but I like to listen. And sometimes you can really learn some amazing stories about what happened in this particular infantry battalion. So I call that book Charlie 1-5, but it does have stories of all the line companies and various situations that we were in. My third book writing effort is in the works. I call it a work in progress, which means it's already taken me 5 years, and I probably have another 3 or 4 or 5 years left to put into it. Books 2 and 3 are a combination of things I experienced and stories from others, which I think is I'm very proud of Charlie 1-5 because it contains individual stories of about 30 Marines serving in Vietnam in the early years, so from 65 through Tet, all the way from battalion commander to rifleman. And I think I have a knack of talking to guys, interviewing them, and then blending these 30 different, very often very different stories into one kind of cohesive history. So I'm looking forward, when I have that third book done, I'll have a trilogy that is focused on 1st Battalion, 5th Marines throughout the entire war. And, so far, knock on wood, they've been very well received inside the military fraternity. Although, since I first started really seriously writing these books, really going, oh, okay, I'm writing this because this is going to be a book. One of my goals has been to reach a wider audience, which is almost impossible in military history. So it's a challenge, but I continue to march. So those are my books.
Do you cover any of the post-war life of your comrades in Charlie 1-5? Or do you just focus on the warriors?
Yeah, very little in these books. I do write about the post-war life but typically op-ed, situational.
Okay.
You know, current events, things happen. Like this past year, 2017, I've written several op-eds about where we are today, and I'm relating it to the nation and some of the things I see as a 72-year-old who, you know, was born and grew up and loves this country, the change that's coming about nationally and internationally, and how it impacts me as a combat veteran of the Vietnam War. And I've long come to the conclusion that although I'm proud of my service and I saw very little of what's been reported by others, the conflict inside the conflict, the blue on blue, if you will,
right,
that I find in modern life, watching a movie, reading a book, when the subject comes to Vietnam, it seems as though many producers and publishers want to tell the stories that are actually caricatures of aberrations. They focus on things that we try to avoid when we're in a combat situation, like collateral damage, one of the worst terms ever, you know, killing people we don't want to kill in war, and things that happen inevitably when you have young people armed to the teeth and told that your job today is to go kill as many of those people over there as possible without getting killed yourself, that these atrocities do occur. But in my mind, what I learned when I was there in Vietnam is that if I had ordered my men, who I knew fairly well but didn't know all that well, to do something atrocious intentionally that would harm, you know, some poor slob out there in his rice paddy or his wife or his kid, they'd have told me to go get fucked. I said, "Lieutenant, we're not doing that." And yet we saw those kinds of things occurring on the other side of the coin. So I'm not really a well-studied person on human various human societies and their outlook, but I kind of came to the conclusion that the Vietnamese, the North Vietnamese that we fought against, didn't think the same as we did in terms of the value of human life. And they saw things much differently. And to us, oftentimes this was atrocious. It was an atrocity. You know, we grew up with baseball and mom and apple pie, and it just really goes against our grain. But there are times when shit happens in combat, and people need to finally understand that. It's not that we're good or bad. It's we're in a situation where we either have to fight and kill somebody or we're going to die. And I've also, as I discussed with you earlier, have been through the wars in terms of post-traumatic stress and all of that, and I've learned that it's not only real, it's both mental and physical challenge that happens to people when they're going through stuff like this. And in our day, we were not really prepared to cope with it. Like you said, the guys came home in World War II, didn't talk about it. They came home en masse, so chances are, if they're on a city street in one block where there's 10 families, probably two or three families have someone living in that house who went through that hell in World War II. But they didn't talk about it because they didn't have to, because they came home to a grateful nation that was, you know, ebullient in terms of, oh, we won, we won, we won. The dynamics of World War II in both theaters are so different than what we went through back in the 60s and 70s. And it's just, you cannot compare them at all. They were different deals. And this one was filled with flaws, like we said, McNamara, LBJ. Then a guy who comes to the scene later in 1971 who wants to be a politician, John Kerry, and he just basically just lies his ass off. and people believe them. So it's, you know, it's a, I've had my entire life to think about this. So 50 years, and I've come to the conclusion that there was a reason that all happened in that way. And it was because our generation of veterans, Vietnam veterans, feel that we want this never to happen again in terms of we've gone to war, we've totally fucked it up, we've ruined the generation of veterans, and we haven't learned anything. So I think those lessons are there. It's just that the right people need to understand those lessons. And one of them is, it's every one of us. When we go into the voting booth, I think we need to really, in today's age, day and age, understand that our commander-in-chief is a politician. He's probably 99% chance he has no knowledge of military affairs, and yet he's the guy that's going to be calling the shots. So when we're getting ready to push the button, we should have at least given some thought to that. And oftentimes it doesn't happen. You can say what you want about Trump, but he's a controversial character. But the one thing I like about him, and it makes me feel comfortable, is that he went all in with Jim Mattis and John Kelly and others, and put them in positions of leadership where I just don't see Jim Mattis making decisions like that. And I think if he gets to the point with Trump where Trump really wants to go off in a bad direction, Mattis will step in and he will challenge him and he will say, okay, if you want to do that after all I've shared with you, I don't know if he would actually threaten to resign or if he would just resign. I'd hate to see that happen.
He would do it sequentially. And I've often, when they were nominated, I said, you know, these are the kind of leaders that the nation needs. And I said, I'll just tell you, you can put a gun to their head and you can tell them to lie and they'll look at you and say, pull the fucking trigger. I won't do that. That's the way these guys, they're not political. I mean, they live in political worlds and they understand it because of the, you know, the rarefied air that they've worked in. But they are, at the end of the day, more than anything else, they believe in the oath that they take and they've seen the sacrifice. And for them, and this is what I wonder about Colin Powell. Colin Powell was in a position, and I had a friend who was a retired lieutenant general at the time. And I asked him, I said, are we going to go to war? Because my friends at Pendleton think we are. And he said, no. And I said, why do you say that? And he said, Colin Powell, not going to let him. Our legacy as Vietnam veterans is that we have not gone down that road to fight another one of these kind of fights. That's our legacy as veterans, as general officers. We all served in Vietnam, and we've been successful at keeping the nation out of these things for the most part. And you know, you can make a case that Beirut was a foray down that road, that Somalia was another foray down that road. And so he said, but by and large, we've stayed out of them. And Powell is not going to allow the president to go there. And then when it happened, I said, what happened? And he said he flinched. He said, the president said, you're my Secretary of State and I need you. And he said, and his sense of duty to the country trumped his obligation to us as Vietnam veterans. He said, and now we're dealing with this. And it was the sadness in his voice I had never heard before. Like that Powell had let down the nation. Now, he didn't, you know, Powell has written a bunch about it and says, well, it wasn't that way and yada, yada. But I think at the end of the day, it was that way. And I think.
Let me interject here because I think this is interesting. I attended a symposium. This is 15 years ago, I think, early in the first decade of the 21st century. And it featured a guy who was the number two American advisor under that guy, Paul, what's his name, the primary guy? anyway, he was the advisor to the Iraqi government post OIF, the first phase, you know, from Kuwait to Baghdad.
Paul Bremer?
Paul Bremer. So this guy was number two to Paul Bremer. I've forgotten his name, which I think is he's an important guy. And so he's making a presentation, and it's a, like an ASCIA thing. So it's a military-industrial complex audience. And when it came time for questions, I asked him one question because I had heard this and it troubled me. And that was that I had learned and heard through all kinds of channels. At that time, I was hooked up with the PAOs in both Iraq and Afghanistan, so I'm not sending stuff to them, but I'm getting all their press releases, that and when the three-week campaign ended rather early and unexpectedly, that both the Department of Defense and the Department of State had developed Plan Bs. Okay, what do we do now? Combat operations are over. We've achieved our goals. We've accomplished our missions in terms of movement forward and capture of enemy territory and so forth. And that Rumsfeld's plan was to leave the Iraqi Republican Army intact and get rid of the top leaders who were Baathists, okay? But leave the Iraqi Republican Army intact, leave them with their weapons, keep paying them, and start moving forward with that basis. So we got security, and we're going to help you in whatever way you need us to help you to rebuild your government and your society. And the other side, no, I'm sorry, that was the Colin Powell plan. The Rumsfeld plan won, mainly because, the Rumsfeld plan was to disarm the entire army, take their weapons away, okay, and the war is over, and you can go home now, so, but we understand that you as an Arab man need to keep your weapons. So effectively, they went with the Rumsfeld plan, which essentially netted the fact that there were 250,000 Iraqi males who were instantly unemployed and fully armed, okay? And they said, go home. Now, I asked the guy, I explained it all, and I looked at him, I said, can you verify that that happens? And he looked at me, and he didn't say anything for, you know, a few seconds. And he says, the first thing he said was, oh, I see you want me to go political. And I stood up, I said, no, sir, I don't. I just want to know, you know, why did that happen? How did that happen? He said, well, let's put it this way. There were two plans on the table, and one of them fell off. He wouldn't go any further, but I could tell that the internal dynamic of the administration, when faced with that, made a real bad choice. You know, they ended up, you know, chasing their tail around for quite a bit. And then time went on, and now we get into Fallujah 1 and 2 and so forth. So I just, I don't know if that's really accurate. It's very simplistic, but I'm interested in hearing what you know about that.
It's pretty close going there. You know, in the spring of 2004, we had done the march up, and then units immediately began, you know, redeploying to the United States because we didn't have unlike the Gulf War, nobody else was paying for this. The American taxpayer was.
Yep.
And so the plan from the beginning was to keep a small force, and General Shinseki, the chief of staff of the Army, had, when asked at public hearings in front of Congress, had said, you're going to need several hundred thousand. And Rumsfeld essentially spit on the idea. Now, the several hundred thousand number came from the war plan. The war plans that we have for all over the world that are pulled out, worked on, dusted off every year. Based on it. And so when you hear a guy like General Zinni, who was CENTCOM, and said everything that happened in Iraq was predicted to happen in the war plan. And we had plans for all of that, right? That's why you needed between 200,000 and 300,000 troops in there to hold the lid on that thing while you transitioned it, quote-unquote, de-bathified the army, which meant replace the top leadership. But just like National Socialism in Germany, you know, if you were a Sunni, you remember the Ba'ath Party. So anybody who was going to be a Sunni and was going to be involved, if the first question is, were you in the Ba'ath Party, then you were not going to have anybody in any position of leadership. And so they went down this fool's errand, and then what they did was they disbanded the army and the police, and there was nobody coming when you dialed 911. So the rationale was every household could have a weapon, right, a Kalashnikov, because there was no police. And I remember getting there in the spring of 2004, and we sent a major over to meet with the police chief of Ramadi to find out, you know, what they had. He came back with a paper about the upper left-hand corner was ripped. It was a series of names written in pencil, and he said, this is the roll call. And people looked at it like, what? And then he said, what about vehicles and what about weapons? They're using their own weapons, and they don't have any vehicles. Radios, they don't have any. And my impression was, wait a minute, we fought this war. What's been the follow-on plan? Isn't this stuff coming? Aren't we going to make them full up round as we transition this thing?
Yep.
And so that was the next question. What about, okay, so what's the plan? Well, there is no plan.
Yep.
There isn't a tanker vessel off the coast that has trucks and weapons and radios? No. Well, what the hell do we do? And I'll tell you this, Ambassador Bremer could not, I sat in meetings, and this is one of the interesting parts of my job. So being General Mattis's butt boy, right? Right. Hey Mac, go get this off.
Were you an aide?
No, I wasn't his aide. I was the staff sec, so I controlled his schedule. I controlled his personnel security detachment. I made sure that everybody who was supposed to be at meetings and, you know, I coordinated. I was his advance guard, if you will, and then, you know, did all the rest of his personal stuff. And so
you were a very busy camper.
Right.
You were a busy guy.
Right. And I'll tell you what, and you did not last long around him if you couldn't deliver and if you screwed things up. And so I at least lasted for about 6 months with him before he rotated out.
That's pretty impressive.
Well, and the intensity of combat where people are getting killed every day makes everything you do more intense. And so And so I had a chance to sit in those meetings when Ambassador Bremer came out to find out what was going on in Fallujah and what was our plan and how do we keep this off the news and how do we dial down the violence in Al Anbar province. And Ambassador Bremer, in my opinion, in those meetings, there was nothing that he wanted more than get the hell out of there. He wanted it all to be dealt with some way, shape, or form by sprinkling fairy dust. But we did not have any of the tools that we needed to fight this insurgency that had been predicted in the war plan that Secretary Rumsfeld tore up and threw away, and we were doing, you know, the world according to GARP. And it was just maddening, because we didn't have the number of Marines, and then you'd see him on TV saying they have everything they've asked for. And you just think, man, oh man, oh man, how are we ever, and we played whack-a-mole until the surge happened. And oh my God, what happened when we surged there? What we all knew would happen from day one. Wherever we are, there isn't shit that's going to go on. We just don't have enough of us. And then what that allowed was it allowed the insurgency to grow up. It made the leaders of Iraq not believe that we were the strong power that we claimed to be, and that this insurgency could survive. And when it got in their heads that this insurgency could survive, both Sunni and Shiite, then that's where you got the makings of their civil war that would go on, and that was the basis for when. And then you had the President Obama. He yanks us out of there. which lays the groundwork for ISIS's entrance onto the stage and our reentry back into it to go fight for those places and support the fight a second time. So
the whole thing is, to me, is
a shit
so
show. Yeah, a shit show.
Transparent that that happened. That those that act, that decision, just basically leave, creating a vacuum, was so predictable. It's hard for me to believe that people even, you know, question it. It's absolutely.
Yeah.
The guy walked out. He told everybody he was going to walk out. He walks out, and then the ISIS starts rising, and people start dying again. It was crazy.
And he did it again, and he was doing it again in Afghanistan. We're fighting in the Helmand province of Afghanistan. It would be like you going back to Quang Tri province, or what's the province around today? So that province that you pretty much controlled, you'd fight in it, but you pretty much controlled and dominated it. We're going back to Afghanistan to fight for a province that we owned. And I was there when he gave his speech that says, we will be out of here by 2014. And immediately our signal intel people who are eavesdropping on their conversations are reporting that the civic leaders, right, and the village elders and the imams in Helmand are calling Quetta, where Al-Qaeda where the Taliban reside, and are saying, hey, look, you know we're cool with you. We hung with you when the Russians were here, and when you came back, we were good. We're doing business with the Americans because we have to, but we're ready for you to come back. And essentially undermined everything. Because you said, and that's why you see Secretary Mattis, you see Chairman Dunford talking about everything here is conditions based. And that means we're not leaving until it's appropriate for us to leave until you're strong enough. And so just frustrating. And again, did we learn any of the lessons of Vietnam? It's not apparent to me that we have. So it's frustrating.
Well, I think one thing that's just occurred to me is, and this was shared with me by a friend who's a Vietnamese American, a guy who was in Vietnam, grew up there, and after the war, many years later, found his way here and built a really nice life here. And that is that we're fortunate, we're blessed that the Vietnamese people, everybody that lives in that part of the world, really didn't have any interest in hurting us or our nation, okay? And so they didn't follow us home.
Right.
50 years ago. That is, that they, being the guys that wanted to kill us, didn't follow us home.
Right.
And that's a different situation today, because it's clear that those guys who were fired and disarmed and sent off whatever they wanted to do, they are interested in following us home and hurting us. So I think we're blessed from the Vietnam history point of view, and this is a much different situation.
No, the whole fundamental Islamic thing is so different, and people
makes my head hurt.
Oh my God, that don't see it and haven't, you know, and haven't had a chance to see it up close. They want to believe that it's not coming to a theater near you. This fight is, and again, I had General Allen on, and people quarrel with this, but I even watched a Frontline show about refugees last night on PBS, and I'll link the two. If we don't come up with some kind of Marshall-esque plan for places like Iraq, for places like Syria, the destabilization of Europe will continue. And that is being fueled by people leaving Syria, Afghanistan, and Iraq, war-torn places, looking for something better. Going to Europe, not finding it, moving into a ghetto, and then turning to some form of radical Islam. And so we have this toxic cocktail that exists on the planet that something has to turn around. And so you can say that, we can't do a Marshall Plan for Iraq. We can't, Syria, it's just too much money. You have to, or else we are going to continue to fight this because they will not let it go. And so, to me, if you don't, if you don't, then you will continue to pay for it. And it is scary. I mean, both my sons are in the military on active duty right now. You know, I mean, I hope my grandson doesn't have to fight them. But I will tell you this, they are not going away. And I think it's they're fundamentally different, because to hear them say it, you will either convert by your brain or you will convert by the sword. But you will convert to Islam. And they believe that. And we just got a taste of it with ISIS. And so,
I don't know if you saw this, but one of the last things on TV that I watched that Jim Mattis was involved in, and this was before the election and all of that, this was a couple of years ago, he worked for a think tank in Palo Alto, affiliated with Stanford University, and he was interviewed, Jim Mattis was interviewed by Wolf Blitzer, which to me was this really odd combination.
Exactly.
Because I could kind of tell from the way they were dialoguing that there was mutual respect there. So my assumption is they had met many times and on many battlefields, and you know, Wolf is Wolf and Mattis is Mattis, and there was respect in both directions. And so I started watching this piece about a third of the way into it, and then I got grabbed, and so I got to watch the rest of this. The very last question that Wolf Blitzer posed to Jim Mattis was, okay, if you were still in that position, which he was CENTCOM, right? Wasn't he CENTCOM when he was fired?
Yes.
Yeah. What would you say to your president today? And Mattis basically, he usually has the answer before you can even finish asking the question, okay? But he thought about it for probably 2 seconds, and he looked back at Blitzer and said, do not broadcast your intentions. And I just went, yep, that's it. you're the commander-in-chief, and you're just blabbing all around the world about exactly what we're going to be doing here. And that's crazy. Sorry, it's nuts. You need to go to Military 101 and learn that the first thing is you just do not want to be announcing to the world, which essentially you are when you're on these TV shows and you're being interviewed, what the hell you're going to do. It's just basic Military Strategy 101. Read The Art of War. Read Clausewitz. Read these things and understand that's the first order to business before you ever take, ever go forward. And then if you just understand what has worked and what hasn't worked in history in terms of military strategy and you adopt that, your chances of success are much greater than if you don't. And by the way, if you're not willing to pay the price, and that this is something you've touched on a couple of times, I feel very strongly about. If the commander-in-chief is being told by his military advisors, these are all the things you have to do, this is the cost in terms of bullets, band-aids, and blood, and you're not prepared to do it this way, then don't fucking do it. Period. If I look back on Vietnam War, and I look at that opportunity in November of 1965 when the Joint Chiefs told Johnson and McNamara exactly what needed to be done and what the price was going to be, and they threw him out of the Oval Office and then proceeded on their merry way. You know, they basically refused to understand the military strategies and tactics that were going to work. And they rejected them out of hand, and yet they proceeded. In my mind, that is a war crime.
It's absolutely immoral.
Force people to go do things that got them killed stupidly. You're stupid, and you're a war criminal. That's my view. It just amazes me. So I just thought that was that interaction between General Mattis and Wolf Blitzer was astounding, because he's right.
And if you've noticed his Department of Defense, they don't broadcast a whole lot of what they do.
Hell no. They're not supposed to.
They don't broadcast shit, as a matter of fact.
Well, basically what they broadcast is, we just bombed the shit out of this airfield out in the middle of nowhere, and this is why we did it.
Right.
You know, that's the way those kind of communications should occur.
Right. My guest today is Nick War. He is a fellow veteran of Charlie Company, 1st Battalion, 5th Marines, and he's a writer. But he's also done a bunch of other things, and we're going to talk about those things right now. But before we leave the whole subject of Vietnam and wars and things like that, I want you to comment on two things specifically. One is My Lai. When I began to study My Lai, I went down a road that it was something that I didn't really anticipate. I thought those guys had been in country for a long time. They had not. I thought they had done a lot of fighting and suffered a lot of casualties. They had not. You fought before you went to Hue. You fought the same enemy that they fought, and not only ambush, booby traps, all the things you see in an insurgency. And so, as I've gone down that road, I asked Carl Marlandis this when I had him on. I asked Major General Jarvis Lynch, who was an operations officer, was rape, was the killing of civilians, was that part of your war? That you fought, not the broader conflict, but was that part of your experience that that was normal shit?
Well, you've asked me two different questions. Was it a part of my war? Yes, it was. What is it, normal? It was absolutely, in my mind at least, it was completely abnormal, despite my knowledge that we're in this situation, which is there are people trying to kill me every minute of every day. I have seen things that lead me to believe that the local villagers are not necessarily to be 100% trusted.
Right.
I've seen all that, and I have had an experience and did two or three times in a 13-month tour that had me in a leadership position in the bush most of that time. So, yes, I saw and dealt with a rape. It came to me in the middle of a dark, rainy night when we're out in the middle of nowhere, and I'm sitting in the bottom of a one-man foxhole about 2 o'clock in the morning, and my platoon sergeant comes and tells me that one of my kids has just raped a woman in the village, and they caught him red-handed, and what do we do? And it's so that sort of thing. Honestly, it does happen from time to time in war, in combat. I immediately ordered him to be, restrained. It was going to be a day and a half before we got back into the compound, the company compound. And the minute I walked back aboard that base, I reported the incident to my company commander, expecting never to see this kid again. He was an excellent point man. Grew up probably somewhere in the woods, knew what the hell he was doing, but he was a little bit out of whack. And so when I was faced with that, the only thing I could think of is I have to report this immediately and deal with this. And that's what I did. Fortunately or unfortunately, the kid ended up getting no punishment because my superior, my company commander, had been warned by the battalion commander that this has to stop. I guess they had a couple of other incidents with rape by Marines on, Vietnamese women. And so that's what they would typically do, is threaten the commander with being fired, basically, which would ruin a career.
Right.
And he ended up not reporting it any further. So I ended up, the kid basically kept his nose clean after that, thank God. I also was blessed with a wonderful platoon sergeant, a Marine staff sergeant of 10 or 12 years, he's the one who dealt with the aftermath, if there was any. I don't recall there being any. But that kid went away with us and fought for a day. But he bugged out when someone broke their glasses, and that person was effectively blind without his glasses. this kid basically broke his own glasses and therefore was medevaced, and that was the last time I saw him. So those things happen. I know they happen. But the image portrayed by the media, by the left, by the anti-war crowd, is it, and thanks to our buddy John Kerry, reporting that this kind of thing happened all the time, and it happened every day, and it had happened with the full knowledge and support of our leadership, which is insane. That's nuts. So yes, it was a part, but no, it was not a part that I was just going to ignore. Okay. The only other incident I recall is right after the night, a long night, when one of my squads just got blown up. Command detonated bomb 700 or 800 meters outside the wire, walking through what's called a friendly village, and boom, three are dead and seven are badly wounded, and the unit itself is basically just shattered. The next day I could follow the progress of one of my day patrols through the ville, watching the hooches go up in flames. And when they got back, I took them aside and I just chewed their young asses out by saying, hey, I understand, you know, it was a horrible thing that happened to us last night, but you guys right now are making this very bad situation many times worse by lighting somebody's house on fire. And also one kid, one of my squad leaders, cut off the chin whiskers of one of the Vietnamese elders. So, but that was the last time I saw it. I stepped in and said, no, you're not going to do that on my watch. And so I'm not saying I'm any kind of a big deal.
But that happens in every conflict. When
everyone, who's fighting who. You could have the Mormons fighting the Quakers.
Right. That's good.
You're going to have that kind of shit. Okay. You just are. So I applaud anybody who wants to end war. Okay. But if you think you're going to be able to conduct a war and not have atrocities, you're a fool. You're an idiot. You should not be in a position of leadership. Okay. Anyway, I ranted on about that a little bit too long.
No.
I hope I answered your question.
No, you did.
That sort of thing.
Because I wanted part to know. Of it. I wanted to know by and after watching it, you know, because the way the Vietnam veterans are characterized, and if I was one of them, it would piss me off. Unless this was in fact true, and that's why I've asked guys, especially guys who fought against the Viet Cong, because if you were up in the Central Highlands fighting the NVA and up in Northern I Corps, the only person you were raping was a fellow Marine. Wasn't the villagers around, and you weren't in a position normally near them because you had your hands full with the NVA and humping up and down mountains and shit like that.
Yep.
So I make it a point to ask. Because that's the way your war is characterized, and were it me, it would piss me off if it wasn't true that rape and killing civilians was a part of what happened to us. It was a part of our war. Not it just wasn't a byproduct of going to war, which you know we've seen in Iraq and Afghanistan, our incidents. In the Marine Corps, you know, the Marines from 3-5 hauling a guy out of his home and zip-tying him and throwing him down near a shot hole, going through the charade of calling in an IED emplacer, and then killing him. And essentially, the line between murder and killing in combat, which is not a thin line most of the time. Most of the time, you know, it's a fairly significant line. And so I wanted to give you the chance to talk about it because I think it's important educational point for people to understand that. And I don't think we do you as a Vietnam Veterans Service. How do I say it? We don't honor your service very well by not delving into that. And looking at it the way we should. So anyway.
I think we got to be brutally honest about ourselves and about what we've seen and what we've witnessed, what we've done. Okay, sometimes that's really hard. You got to be honest about it. But I got to tell you, the impression that people must have, Americans, who have never been in a war situation, never been in combat, seen it on the TV and the movies and all kinds of stuff all the time, is that what you have learned is gone through a filter, and the filter is, I don't want to just use the media, but that's basically what it is. And what they want is they want to sell papers, they want to sell books, they want to sell movies, and the kind of things that the people who buy tickets or buy books or buy movies
right. Are
fascinated by all this ugly shit, which does happen. So, again, I emphasize that much of what's been produced in Hollywood, for example, focus on caricatures of aberrations, okay? They're exaggerations of things that did happen, but didn't happen all that often. This whole broad brush that Kerry painted is it happened every day. It happened at all levels of the chain of command. Everybody was aware of it. We all just covered everything up every day. It's just completely, you can't say it's false,
no. Because
little things, shit did happen like that. And to the person it happened to, it was a big fucking deal, okay? And so I'm not denigrating that. I'm not downplaying that at all. That kind of stuff happens. But the case of Neeli, I think, was a case. It was one of those aberrations. It started as just a small aberration. Someone pulled a trigger. And some point in time, it was very stressful. And no leadership stood up to stop it. That's, to me, the crime of Neeli. It was, I believe, with some courage, it could have been stopped before it got so out of control. But again, if you wanted, you know, the comparisons, one of the things about Mark Bowden's book that I've just reread a little bit is one of the statements of one of his characters who served in the North Vietnamese Army against us in Hue made the statement, which Bowden, you know, completely broadcast and put in his book, that the young officer, who's like a lieutenant, was complaining that it was very difficult for them to fight us because they couldn't get close to us because we frequently would gather up civilians and put them between us as blocks. And when I read that, I was just astounded because we saw that rather frequently throughout the entire war. But I never, ever, ever saw or heard of an American military unit purposely going and grabbing some civilians. Here, mom and pop and kid, come with me. Now stand right over there in front of us because we don't want to get shot. All right, it's just completely, I think this NVA guy had learned so much over the years about what we complained about things that they did, that he just said, well, you know, they did that too. And it's complete bullshit. So, I think it's important for us to be honest and to speak honestly and remember things as accurately as we can.
Let me tell you, which normally doesn't have a path through Hollywood. In fact, I'll cite a very recent example. There's a movie that was out. It was about a female dog handler, and in Iraq, who gets, I believe, she gets knocked out. She's awarded a Purple Heart for being concussed by some kind of an IED.
Okay.
Her fellow Marines that she served with signed a letter that they wrote to the producer saying that this is, the majority of this is fiction, that what you did was not her experience that you're conveying, but you took part of my experience, you took part of his experience, you put it all on steroids so that you could sell a product. And the response was, what's your point? This is a movie designed to make money. And so if you're looking for truth and accuracy through Hollywood, you need to plop down on top of truth and accuracy, overlay over it a big fat dollar sign. When you lay the dollar sign over it, you have your aha moment. So if you're looking for truth from Hollywood, like the whole Apocalypse Now thing. Ask how many guys who lived in the Brownwater Navy, how much water skiing they did. Exactly. You'll find that was some pretty scary shit when you're in the middle of Ambush Alley and in a boat, and you've got to make your living that way. Not a whole lot of time spent doing the things that you saw in Apocalypse Now.
Those things were fairly fast, but we called them slow-moving targets.
Oh, my God.
It was really easy to hit a groundwater boat with an RPG. You didn't even have to be really good at it.
It's not like they were silent. You heard them coming, and you had your positions already prepared. Okay, next question before we move on to your future operations. Next question is your thoughts on the Ken Burns, speaking through Hollywood, although he would reject that. Ken Burns.
I call it a movie because it is not nonfiction. That's where I draw the line. When I'm reading a book, I want to know, is this purported to be fiction or is it purported to be nonfiction? That's a very important distinction. And the same is true for a movie. If it's a movie, it's a movie, and you can do anything you want. You're right. Producers want to blow things up and have lots of action and stuff.
So you would reject the categorization of documentary, which implies, there is no editorial comment in this. It is the words and it is the truth of the pictures as they were taken.
I do, based on my knowledge over the last 20 years of reading and studying and having watched 7 of the 10 episodes, I haven't watched the last 3 episodes of that film. It is purported to be nonfiction. It's purported to be a history-based documentary film. Unfortunately, I watched way too many pieces of the film that are not necessarily factual occurrences. They're stories that are in there that come from other people. I just found that there are just way too many distortions provided by people, right, wrong, or indifferent. I don't know how you feel about the anti-war movement. I understand it. It's human. It's young people. But a lot of what they have said through their words are things that are essentially anti-war talking points. They're not necessarily, in my mind, representative of, for example, us Marines and Army guys and Navy guys who went into combat, who served during combat, and said things that we believe based on our experiences. They're simply regurgitations of these talking points. For example, the characters in that movie said, I think we were wrong to ever go there. Carl Marlandis is a good example of this. I think he's a good guy and a tragic character because he went through some really bad shit, And he has his own view about this being an unwinnable war and getting very angry when he learned about that. The thing I want to really try to stress to people is that we're looking at this from 50 years down the road. And we've had all kinds of time to read and study and a whole bunch of things about the war. But it's really difficult for a person to, in their mind, to go back 50 years, to actually go back 50 years to 1968, or let's say 66 and 67, and honestly put yourself in that place and remember things the way we remembered them, the way they were back then. People have this tendency to talk about the domino theory and just laugh at it and reject it out of hand because, you know, how quaint, how ancient the thought is. But that's the way we felt. That's the way Americans, I mean, we were only, 10 years from, in grade school having to get down underneath our desk for an atomic bomb drill.
And we were, less than five from the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Exactly.
Which is,
you know, so
we don't,
how do you
we don't confront this thing away from ourselves, at some point we're going to confront it very near ourselves, whether it's in Latin America or Central America or whatnot. And I agree with you. That notion of the dominoes falling is poo-pooed now in the light of history. At the time, it wasn't poo-pooed. It was real, and it was this red menace that kept spreading around the globe. Russia builds a wall in Eastern Europe. China, you know, goes communist, right? And the event in Korea, now you fought them there. And so at what point, where does America make a stand? And if we don't, and so to me, I agree, I completely agree with you. People that if you don't put yourself in that time and understand what decision makers were dealing with, then I don't know that you can do that. If you want to judge, history in light of knowledge gleaned 10, 20, 30, 100 years later, then I think whatever you're writing is going to be fundamentally flawed unless you're writing an analysis of what happened. And I absolutely agree with you that it is flawed. So you don't, because I'm sure you've heard reviews, the whole spectrum of reviews of Burns's The Vietnam War thing on PBS. And so you look at it more as another political statement, because I know a lot of Vietnam veterans wouldn't watch it because they said, hey, look, I'm not going to watch another hatchet job on Vietnam veterans on what we fought for. And I know that's at the end of it. I know what that's going to be. Now he pushes back vehemently against that and says that no, we tried to treat it as evenly as we could. But you reject that.
I do. I really think I can't help but come to the conclusion that from the very beginning, when they started working on this, 10 years ago, that it was going to be a very wide treatment, okay? So they knew that they were going to spend quite a bit of time focusing on the folks who had to make the decision, the tragic decision, to either leave their country or go to war, and also those who basically, from the beginning, felt that this was not the right thing to do, and even those who served in war and went back home and turned against it, the Vietnam veterans against the war kind of dynamic. And they were going to spend quite a bit of time focusing on the North Vietnamese soldier, the kid that, one of the best books I've ever read in my life is called The Sorrow of War. It's written by an NVA soldier. This kid spent 10 years in the North Vietnamese army, and on two occasions, he was the lone survivor of a big battle that his unit was involved in, okay? And reading this book, I learned that after the war is over, he goes back home, which is in the north, and he's treated like shit. He can't get a job. I mean, this is just amazing to read this sort of thing and understand and kind of compare with how we were treated as a group. So they knew from the beginning they were going to have, this was going to be more than a documentary film about a battle or a series of battles. It's about the entire war. It's about the people. Here's where they went wrong, I believe, and that is they hardly spent any time interviewing people who had South Vietnamese people who served in the war, South Vietnamese citizens who went through certain things. There were a few. There were also a total of about 20 American combat veterans of the war who were involved in the films, but only three represented what I believe to be the real attitude of Vietnam veterans. The attitude that I've learned about through the VA and other sources is that 9 out of 10 actual Vietnam veterans, people who served in country or were on the ships or flew over us or whatever, were actually ended up being very proud of our service, which took place during a very difficult time in our country, and that if asked to provide service, would do so again. I fall in that category. I can clearly see that a lot of this war was really fucked up, okay? It was really almost a joke. But you know what? I feel that I was called to service. I volunteered. I'm proud of it. I don't care what you say. You can say all kinds of things about how screwed up it was. Yeah, it was in a lot of ways, but in many ways that you'll never know. I'm talking to the whole rest of the unwashed nation, if you will, is there were some really good things that happened to me individually over time during that experience. So, but at the same time, I feel proud, and I'll say that to anybody. I don't care what they say. It's a very, very difficult thing to try to come to grips with. It's a difficult thing to explain to anybody other than someone like you, okay? Mike, you understand implicitly when I say five words, you know, we don't have to define it or anything. We understand. But that's one half of 1% of the nation. It's the vast majority. And I have had that experience many times, especially 30 and 40 years ago when someone would ask about it and I would start to be honest and I would see their eyes rolling around in their head. Okay, and that was the way I put it is, this guy thinks I'm bullshit and I'm telling the truth. And what you do is you turn it off. You just basically go, oh, okay, thanks, have a nice day, and walk away. So it's sometimes really hard to explain, but the bottom line is I'm one of those who did it, who went, who served, did the best I could. I don't think I was any great cheese, but I managed to get through 10 or 11 months of combat without unnecessarily causing lots of death and destruction, you know, and I'm very proud of that.
What's the name of that book again?
Which book?
The book you just mentioned. The Shadow? That a North Vietnamese soldier wrote?
Oh, it's called The Sorrow of War. It is one of the most difficult books to find. I've got a copy of it up here, and I would loan it to you if I could hand it to you person to person. Okay? You know, I have too many books that I love, and I just lend it to someone, and then you never see it again.
The writer is in the documentary, though. He's the blonde.
Oh, is he?
He's the blonde-haired guy, the blonde-haired North Vietnamese soldier, Bao Ninh. Now, let me tell you how I know that. I'm interviewing Carl Marlanis, what's today, last Monday, a week ago.
Yeah.
And I asked him, I thought that documentary was the first time, and the best part of the documentary was hearing the voices of North Vietnamese soldiers, Viet Cong soldiers, if you will. They're more insurgents and not soldiers that wear uniforms. Anyway, I said, I'd never heard that perspective, you know, of them talking about what it was like to fight against us and what they felt during Tet and all the rest of it. And he said, well, if you want to read a great book, I've never heard of this book in my life. Now, I've heard about it twice in a week. He said, read The Sorrow of War. He said,
I'll be damned.
He said, did you notice the blonde-haired guy? I said, yeah, he was awesome. He said, yeah. He said, he wrote that book. He said, and I had a chance to meet some of them because they were filming this up in New Hampshire, and it was an incredible experience. And so I've heard about that book twice in the space of a week. Interesting.
So you say, hold on, I'm going to get it off my bookshelf here. Hang on.
Sure. My guest again this morning is Nick Warr. And we were talking about the Vietnam War. We're talking about his reaction to Ken Burns and Lynn Novick's documentary, The Vietnam War. And so he mentioned a book, and he's the second person in a week that has mentioned this book to me. The other person being Carl Marlantis. So interesting.
Bound In. Yep.
Yeah. Bound
Great
In.
Great book.
Yeah. And he said the same thing. He said, at the end of the day, we had so much in common. He said I just want to see that it's, the version that I just Googled, it's for sale on Amazon. Or is it? It's listed on Amazon.
It's out of print, or at least it was when I first got this book. It was out of print.
You could read it on Amazon. There's a PDF version, for God's sake.
Wow.
Well, I guess I know.
Well, I would recommend it to anybody.
Holy.
The one thing that just flashed through my mind has to do with reading books and how I felt about things 50 years ago when I was just arriving and starting to move around the country. When we moved from Hoi An to that new combat base,
right.
We call it Thulok 6, in late December, early January, 67-68, I was reading The Battle of Dien Bien Phu by Jules Roy. I think it's Wa, but it's R-O-Y. And so we come into this LZ on this bald hill that's completely surrounded on three sides by large, tall mountains, jungle-covered mountains. And I'm realizing this is my new home. And it was just like Dien Bien Phu. Wasn't so remote. Yeah, Dien Bien Phu was so remote. That was their biggest challenge. But I can remember thinking, oh my God, this is my new home. And the Marines very quickly started taking to calling it Little Dien Bien Phu. This is Thulok 6. And thinking, man, we should have been studying this country. We should have been learning about the culture and the history. And one of the kind of funny things I learned is that 300 years before this tent, the Vietnamese planned and executed a brilliant surprise attack over the Tet Holiday against the Chinese. And that's when they ended up destroying the Chinese, driving them out of Vietnam. And so there have been conflicts on their northern border with the Chinese ever since, but that sneak attack during Tet in Hue, 300 years before it happened the second time, would have been a nice thing for us to have read about, because maybe it would have opened our eyes a little bit.
My guest this morning again is Nick Warr, and we're talking about the Vietnam War and different experiences in a wide-ranging discussion. I'll characterize it as that. Interesting. And again, the title of the book is called The Sorrow of War. It's by Bound In, it's showing on Amazon, as being, you can buy it for $6.95 in paperback.
Wow.
Yeah. And then,
That's good.
Yeah, you can buy it new, at a couple of different locations for close to $50. So anyway, there you have the market, or you can buy it as an ebook. You can do that for about $12. Let's transition what you're doing now. You've got, your name, Nick, first, was given to me as somebody who's working on a Vietnam memorial that's going to be built, at San Mateo, the home of the 5th Marine Regiment, as part of their memorial park.
Yeah.
Is that true?
That is absolutely true. We're one of the nonprofit organizations aboard the base that's working to make this happen, and we're making great progress. But really, the story started 20 years ago when that phone started ringing, and very rapidly we had our first reunion. It was mostly Charlie Company guys, mostly guys during my time, I think 67 and 68. And we got together down in Texas, near the burial site of one of my squad leaders, one of the kids that got killed in Wake City during that battle. And gradually, or fairly gradually, we kind of morphed into being a non-profit veterans organization. We're called the 1-5 Vietnam Veterans Association. And our primary focus is to help today's Marines as much as possible with our limited. We're small. You know, I think our total membership is somewhere between 600 and 1,000 across the country. So we like to send care packages when our unit is deployed. Right now, thankfully, everybody's on a training mission. Nobody is actually in a combat role at this moment in time, but that's unusual. Over the last 20 years, I think 1-5 has deployed 7, if not 8 times into the Middle East in combat tours. We especially like to provide scholarships for the young generation, the kids of, in particular, the kids today who are looking to get an education and don't have the wherewithal to do it on their own. So we have supported the First Marine Division Association Scholarship Fund from the very beginning, and we've also launched our own. The story is in Macon, Georgia. And Macon is a real interesting community. It's in the Deep South. It was at one point in time known to be one of the most racially divided cities in the country.
Right.
It's a beautiful place, a lot of great people, and I've met many, many of them over the past 10 years. Buried there in an old African-American cemetery is Sergeant Rodney M. Davis. Sergeant Davis was in Bravo 1-5 in September of 1967, in the middle of probably the most bloody battle that 1-5 ever took part in, called Operation Swift. And during the real moment of close quarter combat, let's put it that way, this is, I've been fighting for an hour or two, and they get so close to each other that it turns into a hand grenade war, where Americans and North Vietnamese soldiers are throwing hand grenades at each other. And in the midst of that, Sergeant Davis, who had only been with 1-5 for 3 weeks, he had had an opportunity, because he'd spent 4 years in London as a Marine security guard. He's married, has two kids, was told at the end of that tour that it's time for him to get out, or he can go anywhere he wants to if he wants to reenlist. Well, he reenlisted and went to Vietnam. He requested orders to go to Westpac. And nobody knew him in this platoon. And all of a sudden, they're in this shitstorm. And one of the eyewitnesses said it was almost funny to watch, because it was choreographed of guys jumping in and out of fighting holes and trenches and stuff, because the grenades would come in, so they'd jump out, then the grenade would go off, and then the grenade would land close to, but not in the trench, so they jump back in. This went on for probably a couple minutes with a high volume of enemy gunfire, but at one point, the timing was bad. The five guys that were in that one fighting hole were all close to where the grenade landed, and Sergeant Davis, without even thinking about himself, just jumped on the grenade. And unfortunately, it blew up at full force. Sometimes they did their Chinese communist grenades, and they didn't always function properly, but on this particular occasion, it worked perfectly. But the people that were saved, who were right next to him, said that his final act was he was scrambling with his hands and his feet to the best of his ability to cover the grenade up as much as possible. And it detonated. It killed him instantly. It saved the other four guys. And the long story short is that they were able to recover and continue to fight, and they end up winning that battle where Bravo Company was essentially surrounded by an NVA, probably a battalion, probably 500 of them, and Bravo Company was 150 or so. Anyway, Sergeant Davis was posthumously awarded the Medal of Honor. His family was approached saying, "Now, your son is a Marine Corps hero, and we want to bury him here with full military honors in Arlington." And they said, "No, we want him home with us." And home with us was in Linwood Cemetery, which is a 120-year-old African-American cemetery there. And so that's where he was buried. And there was an old wooden sign that was up near the family plot. And someone about 30 years ago put up a nice, big, tall flagpole. And so there was a sign and a flag that said, "This is the burial site of Sergeant Rodney Davis, Medal of Honor." I didn't know anything about that. I didn't know Rodney. I got there 2 months after he was killed. But you heard the stories. You knew this story, but about 12 or 13 years ago now, I moved out here to North Carolina in 04. So this would have been in 05 or 06, somewhere around there. One of those four guys who Rodney saved is alive and kicking, and he's visiting his friends or family down in Florida, and says, "Hey, I'm going to go pay my respects." So he goes to Macon, Georgia. He finds Linwood Cemetery. He cannot find the grave. It's completely covered up in jungle. The entire 14 acres of this cemetery, through no fault of anybody, it was a privately owned cemetery, and they got sideways with the city and county governments in terms of something. And so the owner shut it down. Georgia is similar to the Central Highlands in Vietnam in that it's jungle. You know, it's in the south, and it just completely overwhelmed the cemetery. And so I get a phone call from Randy, my friend, and Randy is in tears, and he's telling me that about this situation with Sergeant Davis and his grave. And so, long story short, being the 1-5 Vietnam veterans, decided that since we have a few guys down in this neck of the woods, that we would start going down to Macon two or three times a year and doing cleanups. We're just, you know, one little square at a time. And we got his gravesite uncovered, and the flagpole base was uncovered, and we repainted the sign. And so there was some recognition, but every time we go back, up until about 5 years ago, we had to rebuild that sign every time. It was just an old wooden painted sign. And so a few of us said, "Hey, why don't we try to do something permanent here?" And so we launched the Sergeant Davis Memorial Monument Project. And we launched that 5 years ago, and with our goal was going to be to raise $75,000 to build this granite permanent monument. We got that done. We actually had money left over, and this is where the scholarships come in. So we launched a scholarship program down there in Macon in partnership with the local Marine Corps League Detachment, the Davis family, the Chamber of Commerce, also the volunteers that were coming to take care of the cemetery, Linwood Cemetery. And we had 25 grand left over. Everybody's paid, everybody's happy. So we launched the scholarship program 5 years ago in honor of Sergeant Davis. Since that time, we have organized and conducted several fundraisers. We have found that the hunting sportsmen groups across the country are very patriotic. They're interested in stories like this. They want to do what they can to help out. So we have successfully generated an additional $150,000 that's now in that scholarship.
Wow.
3.5 years ago, I just happened to be out on the West Coast visiting with my close friend, Steve Caldwell, who is a 1-5 Vietnam veteran, and his good friend, Jack Wells, who was with the 7th Marines in Vietnam. And we're standing in the Camp San Mateo Memorial Garden. I'm visiting Southern California, and they lived there. And we're just standing out there, and we've got the CO of the 5th Marines, and we're just talking. And I pointed out our bench. We put in a concrete bench with a bronze plaque on it 15 years ago into the Memorial Garden at Camp San Mateo. We were actually the first memorial of any kind in that piece of. And were you at Mateo before?
Yes.
The Memorial Park was built?
I was. Yep.
So it was just an area, it's pre-area eucalyptus and everything.
Yeah, next to the PX, you know, down by, you know, and it goes down into the wash that you see going out towards trestles and whatnot.
Yep.
So that area.
So our humble concrete bench, which by the way is still there, was the first monument to be placed there. We were in the area. This is a long time ago at a reunion, and we said, hey, we're going to do this, and we visited it, and we dedicated it, and we enjoyed it. But anyway, the three of us are standing there talking to the colonel, and there had been a new memorial built and dedicated to both Afghanistan veterans and Iraq veterans of the 5th Marines, okay? They're beautiful. They're really nice. Other monuments.
Absolutely gorgeous.
Cropped up. And so we just asked the colonel, he said, well, colonel, you know, how difficult would it be to get a Vietnam monument in here? And he said, here's where we've reserved for you. He just walked us right over to the place. He said, we've reserved this whole plot of land right here for just that. He said, the only problem you'll have is you've got to raise a lot of money. And so we started a plan. We established a $400,000 fundraising goal after having gotten a proposal from Rock of Ages. Rock of Ages in Vermont is the company that built the wall, the Vietnam Memorial in Washington, D.C. And they were very creative. We met with the CO of the 5th Marines and his staff. And this was kind of a surprise to me because I'm kind of a historian, and I always think of 5th Marines as 1-5, 2-5, and 3-5, and 2-11 being attached. And he said, no, today it's 1-5, 2-5, 3-5, and 2-4. So if you want to do this, you got to do it to include all four battalions, which, believe me, I had a couple of real interesting conversations with retired Marine generals who just could not understand that. We can't put 2-4 in there. You know, that wasn't the way it was back then.
Right.
But anyway, they just said, well, if you want to do it, that's what you got to do. And we launched the fundraising program. The decision was also that we had to have a mention, a rank, first name, last name, and KIA date for every one of the 2,706 Marines and sailors who lost their lives while serving with 1-5, 2-5, 3-5, and 2-4. That was the other requirement. So it had to be very kind of massive.
Right.
So what we've come up with, and this what is being built right now in Vermont, is the 5th Marines Vietnam War Memorial Monument, which will have the names, ranks, and KIA date, every one of them that we lost during that war. It's coming right down to the wire. Right now we have secured $320,000 plus of money, so it looks like money's not going to be a problem. We'll probably have money left over with which we will do something for Marine Corps-related scholarship programs. One of our fundraisers, I might mention, we ended up in partnership. We've been doing this stuff all on our own, but we came to the attention of the Marine Corps Scholarship foundations, and they wanted to partner with us on the event we do every year up in Pennsylvania. So we did that last year. It came out with really great success, and they want to do it again this year. So it should be finished, and the transportation of the monument pieces is organized right now, planned to be moved from Vermont to Camp Pendleton in the last week in March, and the plan is for the pieces to arrive on what has been dubbed Vietnam Veterans Day in March of 2018, this year.
Of this year.
The dedication is planned for Memorial Day in May 2018. So we're really excited about that. It's just a really cool thing. The causes are really wonderful. People that are Marines, the people that aren't, that know anything about us, have willingly given us lots and lots of money. Organizations and people like Pete Pace wrote us a check. It was a very nice check. Okay, so it's been a lot of fun. It's a big job getting people on board and working together has been described as being as difficult as herding cats.
All right.
I kind of empathize with that because it is. It's a challenge. But over my years in business, I developed a knack for planning and getting people to move forward in a common direction. And so far, knock on wood, it's worked out really good.
Well, I want to have you back on and talk about that because there is a lot of groups that have a lot of noble causes that struggle with that. One is their organization, and two is their ability to raise funds. And you seem to have knocked it out of the park. First of all, just a comment. The first time I think I'd come back from Iraq, when they had, and somebody said, "Hey, Mac, I need to take you down to the Memorial Garden."
Okay.
And I said, "What the hell are you talking about?" And I've been a member of 1st Battalion, 5th Marines in peacetime, was a member of the 5th Marine Regimental Headquarters in combat in Fallujah in 2006. And,
Who was RCT 5 then?
General Nicholson.
Larry Nicholson,
yeah.
Great guy.
Yeah,
I have a picture of him riding a little kid's bicycle down one of the streets in Iraq somewhere.
Yeah, I know. I've seen that, and I think it was in Ramadi, and I think, you know.
That's right.
I feel like that's going to explode any second. Get it away from me. And he said, "I know,
yep.
Mac, don't you?" And it's amazing. But, yeah, and so when I think after we redeployed, after I came home, somebody said, "Hey, you got to see this." And I think it was friends of mine from 2-4 took me down there the first time. And it's absolutely beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. It's in a, like Nick said, it's in a eucalyptus grove. And the monuments are beautiful. I want to say at his dedication, General Kelly was there for the dedication. His son.
That sounds right.
Yeah, his son is obviously his name is engraved on that wall. And so, I don't know how to describe it to somebody when you look at names on the walls of guys that you either medevaced, guys that you know. It's a powerful, powerful place, and I think it becomes more sacred with the addition of the members of the 5th Marine Regiment that were killed in Vietnam. And when I heard about it, I thought, you know, this is awesome, because these places that we have in the Marine Corps, there are places, okay? It's not a public place. It's aboard Camp Pendleton. And so it's going to be out of the way. It's much like the monuments that we've erected in the hills of Camp Pendleton that nobody knows about except us. We go up there and we see whiskey bottles, condoms, medals.
There's a story behind every one of them.
And there is. It's a very personal place for us. There's crosses up there. There's ribbons. There's books. There's cases of beer. But it's our personal places, but it must come with the same power that the Vietnam Wall comes for with you guys. I mean, the Vietnam Wall is powerful for everybody, but to see your comrades, your Marines' names up there, I mean, honestly, it must be hard not to get knocked to your knees when you see that. And to have this, though, be at our home, much like I think we feel about the National Museum of the Marine Corps, which is becoming a sacred place for Marines. It is our Valhalla. If you've ever experienced it, and if you walk around the National Museum of the Marine Corps, you see all the bricks with the names of different Marines, names of a platoon of Marines, names of brothers that served in the Marine Corps. It's absolutely beautiful, but it's ours. It's our yep. tribe's Valhalla, and I think that it's absolutely fitting and wonderful that the work you've done, Nick, honestly, I think it's awesome. I just want to congratulate you. And I do want to have you come back on and talk about how you guys have done it, because a lot of people have great ideas, but they can't seem to solve the fundraising piece. And so, well done.
Well done,
Devil yeah. Dog. Even though you were in the wrong platoon and Charlie went.
Yeah, right. Well, I'm not going to tell you that I'm perfect when it comes to fundraising, because when I started my project to develop this documentary film that I think I've spoken to you about a little bit, I'm completely the opposite. I can't find the niche that I'm looking for, but I continue to march. So I've got just enough knowledge of myself as being a little dense sometimes that I think I can do anything. I have a plan and a team and a good goal and so forth. It's a whole different thing when all of a sudden what you're going to do with the money is create a documentary film. It's a different kind of a deal, but I continue to work on it. The cool part, which nobody who goes to the dedication on Memorial Day will really appreciate, other than the fact of it, is that the centerpiece of this memorial monument is really almost a complete duplicate of the actual memorial monument in Macon. Okay.
Oh, really?
And it's going to fly really well, because the main focus, the centerpiece, is three pieces: a slab of black granite as the base.
Wow.
Probably 5 feet by 5 feet by 6 inches thick. Sitting on top of that is Georgia gray, what they call bar granite, which is a gray, which is pretty substantial. That thing stands by itself 6 or 7 feet tall, and it's 4 feet. And then on top of that is an obelisk that is crafted completely out of black granite. And the obelisk has nothing on it except for on all four sides the helmet, rifle, boots, and grenade iconic image is engraved in all four sides. The way this happened in Macon, and we didn't really plan it this way, is that with correct lighting, when you go there at the right time at night, you see that helmet, rifle, boots image floating in the dark. Okay, it's really kind of spooky. But that's my connection. I kind of insisted on it. Is that's the centerpiece, and if you ever see the one in Macon, you'll instantly recognize it. And we think it's really cool. But then the cool part about Rock of Ages, I mean, I scratched my head and it kind of drove me nuts for like 2 months. I think, how the hell do I get 2,706 names on that? And then they came back and they said, no, you don't. You got to have 8 more chunks of granite to be able to pull that off. So have you seen pictures of this thing?
I have not.
Okay. If you want to, you can look up 5thMarinesMemorialMonument.org. It's the 5th, 5th, Marines Memorial Monument.org, and there's all kinds of photos and stuff there, so that'll bring you up to date on that. But I'm very proud. I am just one of several guys that have worked their asses off. Steve Caldwell, in particular, out there in California, has asked countless individuals and organizations and nonprofits to chime in on this, and he's been very successful. So I'm looking forward to that dedication. I think it's really going to be cool.
No, I'm looking at a picture of it now, and it's beautiful. Wow.
we're well, happy with it.
Well, I'll tell you what, I will be there. I will be there. I can tell you that. I guarantee you that.
Cool.
And
cool.
We'll get to meet. Talk to us in finishing up this epic interview that is pretty effortless. Tell everybody about your trip to Vietnam and what you're trying to do with that.
Well, over this past year, which was in when it started, essentially, it was the year of the Vietnam veteran, because we're in now 1967-1968 time period. And I was just really looking forward to going on the trip. I've been planning the trip itself actually since my wife and I went back in 1998. My wife and my son Brent and I, the three of us, just went on our own. We hooked up with various guides and tour companies, but essentially Pam created the itinerary and we followed it, and essentially we were following in my footsteps. And at that point in time, although I didn't really spend a lot of time lecturing them or telling them stories about what happened in Vietnam to me, it's just a natural over time. They'd heard a lot about it. And so, I was working for a company called Data General Corporation at the time, and I was an outside sales guy, and I hit the jackpot. I just happened to do a huge deal with the VA. And so I had money in my pocket, and it was burning a hole. I had been thinking about going back for quite a while. And I said, this is our opportunity. And so one of the key things to me is if I'm going to be flying on an airplane for 15 hours, is I need leg room. At that time, I was able to buy us not first class, but business class tickets. That made a huge difference. So we went back in 1998, and we were sitting in the house on the address of the house is 72 Mai Thuc Mon Street, which is the street we dubbed as Phase Line Green. We're sitting in that house exactly 30 years to the minute from when the shit hit the fans to Charlie 1, as recorded in my book, Phase Line Green.
Wow.
And the people that we were sitting with, they're Buddhist. They didn't have a word of English. They knew nothing about anything. They had actually purchased this home maybe 20 years before from the original owners. And so they didn't know that all kinds of carnage had happened in their home on February 13th, 1968, our guide basically said, you can talk about anything. I would suggest you don't mention that because they're Buddhists and it would not fly. It would not go down real well. So, but anyway, we were there 30 years to the minute from when the shit hit the fan, inside that house and on that street and so forth. So I was able to accomplish a few things. One of them was I wanted to confirm at how close quarters this fighting was. So I got in the front door of that house, and I paced to the front door of the house opposite, and it was 23 paces. So basically, you're 25 yards range. And I don't know about you, I was a high sharpshooter with the M14, M16. But not an expert. I could have killed anybody across that street because it was so close. And then I also paced how far it was from that house front door to the corner to the right, because when the shit hit the fan, I didn't do the sensible thing, which would have been to turn exactly around, run straight back in the door I had kind of just come out of. I took off like a chicken with my head cut off and ran down that street until I found an opening that I could get through, and it turned out to be 90 paces. And during that entire time, that street is just being shredded by a constant roar of enemy gunfire, point blank range. And somehow I made that run without a scratch on my body. Okay, so it was really great. We saw a lot of the culture of this nation, these people, ancient culture, as well as learned a lot, found the people to be just absolutely warm and welcoming and funny in many ways, and enjoyed our trip. very rough accommodations 20 years ago. Didn't get much out of visiting Saigon, although I was amazed that Saigon at that point in time was a city of 7 million people, and there were a total of 7 stoplights in that entire city at that time. There's a lot more stoplights today, okay, but traffic control in Vietnam is just amazing, and I'm sure it's different in some of the foreign countries you've been in as well, but that was one of the kind of astounding things. Enjoyed the trip and decided then that I wanted to go back on the 40th anniversary and then on the 50th anniversary. Did not have the wherewithal to go on the 40th, but I've been working with Tex Stytler and his crew for about 3 years now to plan this 50-year reunion anniversary by leading what's called the 1-5 Returns to I-Corps Tour. So I'm the historic, I'm the history expert on this trip. There will be about 20 of us. I'm going to have a husband and wife film team with us. The gal is a videographer. She has a videography business. She's the younger sister of a good friend of mine. His name was Travis Kurd. Travis was our second lieutenant RDFO in Way City, and unfortunately last April he passed away kind of unexpectedly. As a matter of fact, I've been putting off calling him and nailing him down, wanting him to go on this trip with me, when I got a call from another buddy telling me that Travis had passed away. It hit me hard. We've lost a few of our guys over the past few years, and that one was kind of the hardest, because Travis has a great eye camera-wise, and he actually went back on his own 20 years ago and just chartered like a moped or a motorcycle and drove all over the country on his own 20 years ago. So wow. I've been wanting to do this a long time. The wherewithal came up when Tex approached me and asked me to lead this tour from the historical perspective. So that was all in the works. And for the first time, last February 13th, as a matter of fact, I sent out a message to all of my guys, Charlie One, and other Charlie Company guys that were in Way. It's one of the things that kind of defines my guys, it's those guys. And most of them, thank God, are still with us today, but we've lost a few. And then to find out that my former battalion commander had put up with me for 20 years, because he had read my book back when it first came out, and had never complained about anything, but he's on my email list, so he responded. He very seldom responded, but he responded to this by essentially telling me that once again, I had my head up my ass and I didn't know what I was talking about. Okay. That everything in my February 13th note that went out to pretty much everybody in the battalion was not right. And so I started to correspond with him, and I've come to learn that I don't think he remembers things as they actually were. I think he now believes what he wrote in the Combat After Action Report back in February 1968, which is not 100% accurate, is not 100%, okay, that he actually... The bottom line is, once you read my book, you'll know this was the moment. 13th of February was the moment for me in terms of my entire tour in Vietnam, that we were essentially wiped out. I had 51 guys when we went inside that fortress, and at the end of the day, I had 26 or 27 sets of dog tags in my head. They were either dead or they were so badly wounded that they were on their way home. And there's not a single entry in the Combat Action After Report for 1-5 for the 13th of February, 1968. It's as though we didn't do anything. We weren't there. Nothing happened. But fortunately, I got the diary record that does confirm that five of my guys were killed and 23 or 24 were wounded and evacuated. And that seems to have been totally lost in history. And I've noticed that in the past 20 years since I've kind of been awake and conscious, that books that have been printed since then don't have any, it didn't exist. And it really kind of got me pissed off. But now, and he has pretty much refused to respond to any further queries. So I have told him, I said, look, he made a couple of statements that I know to be false. And I told him that. But I was there. I saw it. I know this is not true. And I know these other things are true that I've reported in my book. But for some reason, you are not supporting that any longer. So that started me really getting wound up tight and added to my fuel. And then in August of this year, the Mark Bowden book was released. And then in September of this year, the Ken Burns movie was released. And the combination of all of those things have net-net motivated me to take on one more major project challenge, and that is the creation of a documentary film that I call The Forgotten Marines at Way, TET 1968. And there's really three groups. One of them is my platoon. At the end of that day, there were so few of us, and by the way, we were the only attack element throughout that entire day. There were firefights going on all up and down the street, but we were the only units that were ordered to attack. The conditions for the attack were 50 guys in one block in two-story buildings, facing I think 200 to 300 NVA soldiers inside the block on the other side of the street from us, with positions, and keep in mind they'd been there for 2 weeks already, positions prepared by digging holes between the houses and reinforcing them, by putting sandbags behind the windows and the doors on both floors of every house, machine gun positions on the roofs. That was facing us straight across. We also were under fire, NVA hiding in the houses to the left and to the right of them facing us directly. And then about 200 meters to our left is the Dong Ba Tower, which stands at about 50 feet height and dominates that entire street. So they had probably two or three squads and NVA in that tower that had automatic and semi-automatic weapons. You have this huge matrix with a crossfire, and that's essentially we met them the first time by accident. We just walked out the front doors and they just started tearing the shit out of us. After that, we were ordered three times to attack. The third time, we got two guys across the street uninjured, but it was late in the day, and we could not follow up on it. No such thing as night vision gear. I'd love to have had that. They did have a device you could carry around with you and look through it, but it was big and clumsy. So it was really kind of odd that throughout that battle, when it was going on, kind of by mutual acclamation, the gunfire stopped at about an hour after full dark. And nobody shot or did anything until after first light the next morning. Just like we just turned the war off and went to sleep. We did so cautiously, obviously, but there was only one instance through the next 2 weeks where there was fighting in the middle of the night. And it was just kind of scary. So Charlie 1 was basically determined to be combat ineffective. I'd lost 65% of my guys. And so they took half of them, and they sent them to 2nd Platoon, and they took the other half, and they sent them to the 3rd Platoon. And I worked for the gunny for a day or two, just unpacking. We had 60 Mic motors with us, and although we were under orders not to fire them, it was like, okay, come up here and take it away from me, because this is the only thing we've got that has any kind of a... We had those and the M79s, the 40-millimeter grenade launchers. But we could not get any direct support from artillery or air or naval gunfire. Was a joke anyway. It wouldn't have worked in those situations. And there were so many things in the Burns movie and so many things in the Bowden book that are just wrong. And one of the things is it became very personal to me because he basically believed, here's the thing, he believed Thompson's version of the story more than he believed me.
Thompson is the battalion commander.
Is the battalion commander, yeah, Bob Thompson, Colonel Bob Thompson. That's the way I reacted to it, so it got me really going. So over since about March, I've been putting together piece by piece a project plan to create this documentary film. Never done anything like that in my life, but it's like writing a big book, plus it's multiple it's a matrix of things you got to do, not just, you know, type a word, type another word, and so forth. So it's a big project. I have interacted with a number of very rich guys who are fascinated by the story, and they're willing to help, but they want to help by supporting a non-profit enterprise initiative. And so I need a bank. That's the one piece of my puzzle that I have not yet put together, but I'm working on it, who is a nonprofit, a 501c3. If you know anything about nonprofits, I'm looking for a 501c3 who will act as our project banker. So if Mark Embro says, I'm going to give you 10 grand, I don't want him to give it to me. I want him to give it to 501c3. Who puts the money in a safe place, and then when I need to start writing checks to pay for production and post-production, it will be a legitimate non-profit 501c3 donation for the sponsor or the donor. And that seems to be, once I've got that, which I hope when I get back from Vietnam, I will have done that, I've got money starting to flow in for the post-production. We're going to do a one-day shoot at Camp Pendleton in the Memorial Garden on Saturday, February 3rd, if you're interested.
This year?
Yep. So I'm leaving here.
Yeah, that's next week, for God's sake. Yeah, I'm interested.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. It's all coming really fast. Whenever I know I'm going to be going west, around February, I try to work in the 1st Marine Division anniversary event, which is a lot of fun. You've probably been involved in those.
I never have. I've never been doing something, but it happens next Friday. It happens next Friday, and so
And I'm going to get there Wednesday afternoon, LAX. I got to rent a car and drive down, but I'm staying with Steve, who lives in Carlsbad. And then I'll be going to the event Thursday and Friday, which wraps up with a banquet Friday evening at the what used to be called the Staff NCO Club, right inside the main gate there.
Right, it's now called the Pacific Views Club.
That's it. Yep.
The same thing.
And then Saturday I'm bringing a very small film team aboard, and there's about half a dozen guys, including myself, but guys like Scott Nelson, who was my company commander, Inway, one of the corpsmen who was there with us, and I think that's a story that hasn't been well told, what our U.S. Navy corpsmen do, you know, what they have to go through, what they have to live with. And so we're going to do a one-day shoot inside and outside, but a part of it in the garden itself, that they're going to give us a classroom. I think they're going to give us the the meeting room for right outside the door of the commanding officer of the 5th Marines.
Wow, the conference room. That's awesome.
Yeah, which is really cool. Yeah. Yeah. It's got all that memorabilia and those photos. Some, a couple of things that have happened over the years is whenever I get close, we have a reunion on the West Coast, which is every 3 or 4 years, something like that. I'll try to spend at least a day aboard Camp San Mateo, because when I got out of boot camp in summer of 66, I went to MCRD San Diego. That was my next home. Infantry Training Regiment was at Camp San Mateo. And after I concluded that, I had to wait 4 months there for orders to go to OCS. So I lived at Camp San Mateo as a PSC, and knew all about its idiosyncrasies, including the rains that cause problems for the guys who want to go home on the weekends and stuff like that. So, and so Saturday, we've been given permission to do this shoot, to focus on a few of the guys who want to be in the film but can't go on the trip.
Right.
And then, so that's Saturday, the 3rd of February, and then I leave Sunday night, the 4th, from LAX to fly to Taipei and then on to Vietnam.
Wow.
My whole intent is not to contradict or condemn either Bowdoin or Burns. It's to simply provide another important piece that fills in some of the blanks. Okay, those guys, the budget for the Burns movie was $30 million. It took them 10 years, as I understand it. They spent $3 million a year for 10 years. So it is, in terms of scope and color and all that, it's very seductive. It's very easy to watch all that. It's only when some of this stuff starts creeping into the fabric of the history that I know to be false, or somebody's opinion as opposed to actual historic facts. I belong to a very loose-knit organization called Vietnam Veterans for Factual History. If you're at all interested, just go to vvfh.org/wiki, and there are dozens and dozens, if not hundreds and hundreds of pages of various works by guys like me, although some of us are really historians and researchers more than a veteran who wrote a book. And out of that group, probably 95% of the dozens and dozens of reviews of the, in particular, the Burns movie, are absolutely critical, negative, about one thing or another or a few things. Okay, it's interesting. They don't all zero in on just one thing. We don't. I just finished writing a 3,000-word essay on the Bowdoin book, and I had to remove quite a bit. I had to chop it down 600 or 700 words just to be reasonable in length. I think it's got enough interesting facts to grab people and keep them reading. But that book is in my worst moments, I refer to it as being replete with stinkiosity. It's got all this stuff, and I look at it, and I go, how the fuck could you reach that conclusion? You
know, with that sort of
like,
facts.
Holy cow. Right. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
All right. Well, first of all, Nick, I cannot, you know, what you're doing simply relative to honor Vietnam veterans in a very personal way, in a very Marine place, I cannot praise you enough for doing that. It's a beautiful place. It's a Marine place. And it's absolutely appropriate, and I want to congratulate you for doing a lot more than simply talking about it and making it happen. So congratulations. I look forward to actually meeting you next week, and so I'm excited about that. And then,
oh, cool, you're going to come.
Yeah,
okay.
I will find you. And then and the other thing I'd love to do is I'd love to have you back if you could provide me with a map of Charlie Company's fight. I do a thing called battle studies, which is designed so that young leaders, non-commissioned officers, junior officers can listen to it and glean lessons learned from somebody's fight somewhere on the planet. And I'd love to have you to walk through the beginning of that fight with you and talk about the lessons that you learned out of it and use you and Charlie Company 15 as in Hawaii as a battle study and pass it on to other Marines and the only thing I need is a map chip from you and whatever else you'd like to provide I'd happily put it up on the net but normally what we do is we take a map chip and we just spend an hour and talk about your actions and then lessons learned that you would pass on to other professionals that may walk down the same path as you. So I'd love to invite you to do that.
Be very honored to do that. I can actually give you a couple of tools immediately that were developed. One of them in particular is a decision forcing exercise,
right,
what they
right.
call it, DEX.
Right.
That is based on Charlie. Well, they call it Charlie Wants Me. They take these and they've done this on many occasions now for several years at both small unit leadership courses on the East and the West Coast, and also in not so much OCS, but the basic school and the IOC in particular.
Right.
This decision-forcing exercise was developed specifically for the Marine Corps University for use in the IOC, and now it's branched out. So I personally led one. I had 18 E5 sergeants in the same room for an entire day. It usually is a 1 to 2 hour thing, but this one was because it was heavily supported by the cadre that support, you know, the NCOs, the staff sergeants, gunnies, and above, who run that school at Camp Lejeune. And it's called Charlie One. Essentially, they bring one lieutenant at a time in to a room, and they sit him down, and they say, okay, here is your five-paragraph order. You are a Lieutenant Ward. You're the platoon commander at Charlie Company 15. Here is your mission. This is the situation. It's a SMEAC, okay? It's all done the way it was done back then.
Right.
And they then give the kid his rules of engagement, and that's the end of the exercise on the cadre side, because they say, okay, Lieutenant, what do you do now? That's that question. They ask us many times, and they put us in those difficult positions. And what I've learned is that almost everyone has responded by saying, no fucking way would that ever happen. Why do you want us to do this? That could never happen.
Right. And then I'll tell you, and that's why those decision forcing, decision making exercise exercises that are linked to history are so powerful, because at the end of it, you know, you have a, you know, he presents his course of action, and then you can even actually kind of walk through it a little bit, and then at some point you shut it off, and at the end of it you can hand them and say, now read this. This is what actually happened that day, and it's so powerful. And it's so illustrative in terms of learning lessons that you can learn from other people. And so I'd love to do an oral history version of that, if you don't mind.
Absolutely. I have a very large scale map, a hard copy of the city of Hawaii. It's 1 to 10,000 in size. So,
wow.
We used 1 to 50,000 terrain maps.
Right.
And I have that, but it's so dinky you can't hardly see anything. One of my wife's assignments when I'm gone, so I think she's looking forward to getting me out of here. she's going to be busy, is to go somewhere and scan that big thing in. And over the years, I've cut it apart and put it back together again and doodled on it. I want her to scan it and create an image that I can manipulate for my own purposes. I'm going to be doing what the MCU did with this decision forcing course, which basically zeroes in on the block and the terrain and the houses and so forth. So I will definitely, once she gets that done so that I can start manipulating it, I'm going to use it for a variety of reasons. I'd be happy to give that to you as well.
All right. All right. Well, Nick, first of all, I appreciate you taking so much time out of your day and joining us here on Allmarine Radio. It's been an absolute pleasure to make your acquaintance.
I enjoyed it. I considered it fun. At the same time, you know, we went back into places that I was in my life that are kind of dark. But I've done it so many times now over the last 20 years that it's not hard for me anymore. You know, I get more out of it. What I tell people is, listen, thank you for inviting me, okay, because I enjoyed that very much. And enjoyed these conversations with you in particular because I don't have to explain anything to you. The details, the messy stuff that's caught between the cracks. And I end up feeling so much better that people are out there in your generation and in the younger generations that are, they want to really learn about this stuff in a way so that they can avoid harm down the road. And so I get a lot more out of these things. The monuments, everything that I do, I get so much more out of them than what I put in, which is usually stuff that's kind of second nature to me anyway.
Right.
And you should know by now that I love talking about this stuff. The veterans do like talking about it because the important thing is every year the stories get just a little better.
Yeah, and some of them don't need any embellishment to be good. To
that's
be honest
true.
With you. But no, you know what? It's one of the things that I've grown to love about doing Allmarine Radio. There's special people that join the Marine Corps, and I don't believe you're ever as happy that you join the Marine Corps as when you have to go fight in a war, and you look around with the other crazies that joined with you, who are who put their fear aside and who walk towards the sound of people shooting at them, and that is not a natural reaction. But the Marine Corps is a very, very unique group of human beings that that looked at our boot camp and said, "Yeah, I'll try that." When there was other alternatives that were not nearly as stressful or difficult, and so that group, that first wicket that human beings go through in the selection process is a huge one, and you then for me you get to meet others that have gone before you. And I will tell you that we are still very conscious of the long shadow that Iwo Jima Memorial casts. I know that you were as well, but for us, you're included in that now. And so I can vividly remember setting foot in Iraq thinking, I don't really know what's going to happen to me, but I do know this. I'm going to do my job. I'm not going to fail other Marines. And then whatever else happens, happens. But I'm going to be a Marine, and I'm not going to fail. And it's that legacy that makes meeting guys like you wonderful, hearing the stories of the burdens that they bore, that they bear today, and how it made sense to them. It makes this truly a wonderful experience for me. So it's our privilege to have you on, Nick, and thank you very much for spending all the time you spent with us. And I look forward to, you know, to doing the battle study with you when you get back.
Cool.
And hearing more about my company, Charlie Company 15. So thank you very much.
I look forward to that very much.
All right.
I got to say one last thing, and that is that the cool part about going to reunions is the predominant noise at a reunion is laughter. And after what a lot of these guys went through, both during the war and for years and years after the war, that just makes me, it's the best thing in the world to see these guys, and some of them are still suffering from wounds, both visible and invisible, and yet here they are laughing their butts off, which is great. Thank you very much, Michael. I enjoyed it. It was an honor to spend time with you.
And we'll do it again, and we'll meet next week.
Sounds good.
All right. There you have it.
Take care.
That is Nick War on All Marine Radio. More of it coming up next.